I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hi everyone, welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm Tom Meissen with Kenny Neibert and Phil Iskove, and we're talking Sleepy Hollow. How was that?
I mean, we can't do better than that, really.
That was good.
That was great.
Keep it in. We're talking Sleepy Hollow here. We have Tom Meissen, the least problematic Ichabod Crane, and Phil Iskove, the least problematic creator of a Sleepy Hollow inspired
interpretation.
Guys, this is a once in a lifetime thing.
It is.
No, I have, as the host of this podcast, because Phil, today I don't really think you're the host of the podcast. You are an appropriate guest. You are a great get for this podcast, as are you, Tom, to talk about 1999's. Phil's the brain.
I'm not wearing a t-shirt. I've just noticed that Phil's wearing.
Yeah, so I'm wearing a
Is it official?
Yeah.
It's not.
Sign on to our Patreon to find out if Tom is wearing anything at all. But
just AirPods.
But here we are. We're talking 1999 Sleepy Hollow, a film partially inspired Phil to create Fox's Sleepy Hollow with Alex Kurtzman, Bob Orsi, Roberto Orsi, and Len Wiseman. Mm-hmm. And cast Tom as Ichabod Crane. Tremendous show. You guys were obviously, Tom, you were fantastic. Phil, you were a great writer. And you once were.
I once was.
and it's really great to finally kind of be able to open this present that that's been sitting on the table for the beginning of this podcast.
I had no idea it was 99. I had no idea this
was 99. That's the reason we're doing the podcast.
It's funny though, because like, you know, Kenny and I talked about this at the very beginning where we knew that this was sort of sitting on the horizon. And I was just like, I want to do it, but I don't really know how to do it. And I don't know who I'd want to bring on for it, you know, and obviously, Tom, you've been on a couple times now, and it just felt like a no-brainer to bring you on to talk about, you know, not just in terms of, you know, your involvement in the show, but just, you know, you saw this movie, we texted a little bit about this, how you mm-hmm. you'll obviously tell us your story about how you saw Sleepy Hollow for the first time, because it's great. But I also just feel like, you know, this short story has been interpreted a couple times. A bunch of people have kind of taken wax at it, and they're all very different in their own ways. But, you know, this feels like do you think it's this version? Or do you think it's the Disney version that people, speaking from film as opposed to television, you know, have you shown your kids the Disney one, Kenny? Like, is that something that they even know?
No.
And so you watched the movie the other day with your son who had not seen it before, correct?
Yes.
What did he think of it?
He really liked it. And I think period is a bit, particularly, you know, this far back, is a bit of a, you know, barrier of entry for some kids that age. But look, he's a big fan of heads being cut off.
Sure.
And he loves and every, you know, the thing is, you know, Rollins a bit, listeners have heard this. He really can't be scared by anything. It's just his thing. He just doesn't get scared.
Yeah.
But what he said at the end was, he goes, well, it wasn't scary, but at least there was a great story. So that's good. That's a big win.
That's fantastic. You know, I will say though, so I saw this film in 99. I'm a very big Tim Burton fan, and we're going to do our top five favorite Burton films at the end of the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to do that as well. But I was very excited to see this film. And, you know, when I sat down to try to come up with ideas to pitch, Kenny was very much a part of that as well. He might very well remember. I remember IMing with Kenny about the Sleepy Hollow pitch, and as I was coming up with it, and Kenny was instrumental in that. So, you know,
isn't that weird?
So Kenny does
that. We were friends that long ago.
We were friends that long ago, and I was sitting at my desk as an assistant at UTA. Kenny was sitting at his desk wherever, I don't know.
I remember exactly where I was, because it was before I had kids.
Yes.
And it was a period of time where we had, you know, the second room. We had the second room in our apartment that I put a desk in that was my office for a couple of days until we had kids. But yeah, I remember exactly where I was when you sent me. And I, by the way, I tell this story all the time. And I almost want you to tell the story.
Well, I'll tell it from my perspective, or what I remember.
Not the my part of it. Like the story of you, because I think it's a really great story in general. And I think there's a lot to unpack there. So, I remember you basically sending me 10 ideas, 10 broadcast-worthy ideas. Sure. And I think you had maybe already narrowed it down to two.
It was down to two,
I think or maybe, you know, you sent me the 10, and then later you said these are the two that we're going to focus on. And I think we talked about it for a little bit. And I just threw some ideas at you, and I said you should cast Tom. And that was my big idea. And go ahead.
I don't want to make a whole big thing out of me coming up with this idea, because lots of people were involved in how this became a television show. But I will say that, you know, I sat down in front of, you know, various pieces of public domain and saw that Washington Irving had created or written, obviously, Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle. And I texted Kenny. We were IMing about this. And I was just like, I want to have this guy, he's Ichabod Crane. I want to have him in present day, but like, is it just a present day Ichabod Crane, or, you know, what exactly should that be? And at the time, and I think I've said this to you as well, Kenny, but I'll say it again, which is that at the time, shortly around this period, the trailer for Dark Shadows had dropped. And as those who remember or have seen this movie, basically he's a vampire who is buried alive by a witch. who, and then he wakes up in 1970s. I believe it's New York State or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. It's somewhere around, anyway, or maybe it's more coastal. Doesn't matter. Long story short, that plus Kenny saying, why don't you just put the guy to sleep? Was sort of this kind of this moment where I was just like, oh yeah, just he'll just be a man at a time, and he'll be Ichabod Crane from 1799. And I mean, obviously, yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
Two questions. First of all, so interest. What had your pitching experience been before?
So I had pitched a couple shows up until that point. I had written a pilot that had gotten some traction, and I had been pitching mostly to like ABC Family, MTV, that type of stuff, because the mm-hmm. pilot that I had written was teen oriented. So I had pitched a couple things. But to answer your grander question here, when I think about how little I went into that room with Alex Kurtzman with, it gives me chills, like to this day. Like I was so crazy unprepared for that pitch, in my humble opinion now, knowing what I know, that I didn't have much more than Sleepy Hollow, huh? Like I really did not have much more than that. Which again just frightens me to my core. I'm just thinking.
But then that shows the enduring appeal
of this
story, but actually not the book, because the book, as I'm sure we'll discuss, is shit.
It's not great.
I want to say one other thing, because you're being super humble. That's not totally true. You didn't have nothing. You had a lot, because then I also remember sitting down with you at King's Road before you went in, and you had a lot at that point. You really had a full, you know, you had a full story. You had the idea of Abby. You had everything that was like, you know, kind of fundamentals, elementals of the show. The other thing I want to say is, it's not just as simple as Phil saying Sleepy Hollow and putting his hands out, jazz hands. There was another pilot that same season.
That's true.
That was, I think, called like Ichabod or something like that.
I don't remember what it was called. There was a CW thing.
There was a CW pilot, and it was the same in that it's Ichabod Crane modern day, but it was different in that. It was Ichabod Crane is just a guy.
He's just a guy who
works at the FBI. who I think, and now I'm extrapolating, but I'm sure this is what it was. I'm sure it was an X-Files thing, where he's some guy who investigates things like phenomena like the Headless Horseman,
right?
Which, by the way,
characteristics that we know of. Ichabod Crane.
Yes,
I mean this was right. Which it sort of comes back to the movie a little bit, in the sense that. My pitch to your original point, Kenny, in terms of like, I was trying to build something a little bit more procedural, something that was a little bit more sort of a, Mulder Scully kind of situation, if you will, a little more Buffy-esque, a little bit more sort of like hardwired into the case of the week type of thing. And part of that stemmed from the film, which is a reinterpretation of Ichabod Crane, who's not a detective in the original source material. He's a weird, teacher. Fastidious teacher. And they turn him into a detective.
Smacks the kids, I seem to remember.
He does.
Several paragraphs about...
He's a dick. But yeah. But my point to you, here... Yeah, sorry.
Yes, I'm going to finish the sentence because I'm an asshole. It's something that I noticed rewatching the film, is that, you know, as I say, the book is quite shit. There's not an awful lot to it. It's mainly lists. Yeah. It's lists of crops and things.
It was like, that was kind of Washington Irving's thing. He wrote like these weird diatribes. There were like lists. He was like an almanac writer more than like a fiction writer.
Weird. Very strange. So, in order to adapt it, you need to bring your own completely new story to it. And so in the film, it's, you know, it's the whole Will thing and the horseman being brought forth. Yeah. And with you, it was, I mean, I can't stop thinking about it since we started talking. To have the Headless Horseman as one of the horsemen of the apocalypse was just a brilliant, brilliant little twist on it. And I'm not surprised that you didn't need to go in with a great bit, and I'm sure you're being, you know, self-deprecating. But
I will say, though,
knowing Alex as we do now, of course that's Buck's.
Well, he was just to sort of to give a sense of what that meeting was. The thing that we really hit on was Twin Peaks, which won't surprise anyone who knows Alex, who's an enormous Twin Peaks fan. You know, I wanted to create, and we wanted to create a weird little town, right? And it's, you're not going to find a more iconic name than Sleepy Hollow in terms of knowing that it's a weird little town and that there's a headless horseman. And so it's very fertile territory. To your original point about how the short story might not be great, but it created this petri dish that so many people have been able to kind of glom off of, which I think is really fascinating. I think that this movie capitalizes on that beautifully, in my opinion, of really bringing that to life better than anything, you know, I could imagine.
This movie never would have worked as a TV show because the character of Ichabod in this movie is has no legs. But as opposed to the villain who has no head. But the little...
Written that down in his notebook and he'll tick that off. Got that gag out.
Right off the dome.
Right off the dome. just like, what have you put him to sleep? So, but the little brilliant thing you guys did, Tom, you had very little to do with this, but the really brilliant thing that you did with your with Kurtzman and Orsi that made this a TV show, it was a very, there always is little what ifs, right? It was, what if Ichabod Crane was cool? It's what if Ichabod Crane was a formidable opponent for the Headless Horseman? And the way you show that as him being a member of Washington's army with that opening scene with them basically killing each other, that, and then the blood, that little thing makes you want to go on a ride with Ichabod, no pun, for, you know, how many episodes you guys get? 70 episodes? For 70,
80, yeah.
For 80 episodes because he's cool. Right. And that, and then that, then the relationship with Abby works, and it wouldn't have worked the same way if he was any of the other iterations of Ichabod. And I remember you having your meeting. It was like your first creative meeting with Alex and Bob after you kind of agreed to kind of go through this, and you came back and you're like, you won't believe what we came up with. And I at the, like, that plus what you're talking about, Tom, that plus the pulling in the, so it's pulling in the Bible and pulling in the American history, the Washington stuff, where I'm like, oh yeah, I said it to you. I said, I am positive you guys are going to sell this. I am positive this is going to be a show. It's the only one I could think of from, no offense, you know where you are at this point, from an unknown writer, that the idea was just undeniable. It was an irresistible thing.
I will say, and I do think that an important detail was that I kind of always saw him as British. And this isn't me, you know, being like, they didn't get it. It was just sort of like, I didn't see him as American. And it wasn't even because of the historical components of it. They literally said to me, I remember they were like, who's your dream casting for Ichabod? And I said, David Tennant. Because there was that sort of Doctor Who kind of British component that I saw in my head. And, you know, they at that point were like, no, he's American. And I was like, okay. And we, you know, we did our due diligence. We did a bunch of, obviously, we as Tom knows, we did a lot of auditions. But ultimately, it was when we realized that that history was our friend in terms of having him be British, and that it all kind of works out when you have the Revolutionary War and all of that, all those, the confluence of those things coming together. Because I really, really believe in my heart that, obviously, Tom, you were phenomenal in the show, but just that he really just needed to be British. I just couldn't imagine.
Well, I know a few of the actors who were chosen before me and all American, and it's hard to picture. And I remember when I taped in London for it and was asked to do it both with a British and with an American accent. Yeah. And it then surprised me that it took so long for everyone to realize he should be British, because it just didn't.
Nope.
It's going to sound very pretentious, but it just didn't feel right. It didn't fit.
The verbiage coming out of his mouth, we did many auditions, and every time. And his interrogation, Ichabod's interrogation scene was the audition scene. That was what actors, as I'm sure you remember, Tom, was what you were auditioning with. And the very first line is, "My name is Ichabod Crane." I can't tell you how many actors said Ichabod Crane, like just right at, like just straight out. Said Ichabod. So like they're dead in the water before they've even started, they're dead. And then they go and everyone did it like Christian Bale in Batman. Everyone delivered these lines with this like gruff, weird, gritty authority, as though, which again shows they don't know the character, obviously, because they don't know his name, but they also just don't have like any, you know, context for it. And to your point, a British accent, first of all, makes everything just sound better, but also just it creates a level of authority or a level of wit and intelligence, whether or not you have any of that, Tom, is yet to be determined. But I do think that Brits do convey that.
Tom, I'm so embarrassed that I watch every episode of this show and you're really good in it, but I can't remember. Did you do an American accent in Watchmen?
No,
in Watchmen.
So how is your American accent?
Well, I'm doing it in C and no one's punched me yet.
Okay.
But mind you, I'm surrounded by Canadians, so.
And you don't want to be punched by those guys, I think.
Not by Bautista and
those are some good punchers.
I don't mean to cut you off, but the C accent, because I have watched a couple of the episodes of the new season and it's an interesting accent because I know that it is American, but it has
the show is heightened, slightly off,
right? Like there's something kind of off about it, right? Am I crazy? Okay.
Yes, that was one of those choices that I make where I want to do it a little bit off, and then realize after I've started doing that, it might just sound like I can't do an American accent. Oh shit! Well, it's too late now. In for a penny, in for a pound. Here we go.
It's great. Sometimes, I do like it.
Sometimes you make choices, and it, and in your head, it's really clever, but in practice, you're just a bad actor.
So let's go a little further on this, and we can relate it to the Burton movie. Tom, you got this. I don't really know how it worked. Did you get sides? Did you get a script? Did you get
did you get the whole thing, or did you just get sides? I don't remember.
No, I got the whole thing. I remember it was the first year that I had ever been up for pilots. I was never available before, and then I was like, "Yeah, send me everything." And so in London, it's not pilot season in quite the way that it was in LA, which mercifully I always managed to avoid. But I did love seeing the exodus of British actors going to LA for pilot season and coming back a month later, 10 grand poorer. And still
in my head, I'm envisioning them all waving from a ship.
It's exactly that. And the rest of us who can't afford to go to LA, just blowing kisses and waving them off and saying, good luck, hoping, like in Good Will Hunting, that we'll never see them again and they'll just be very successful. Yeah. But then they all come back. And
it's not what I hope. I hope they give me a call and say, you want to do a guest spot.
Yeah, right.
I hope the fucking boat sinks.
But we sent you, I remember seeing tape for you before you flew out here. Right?
Oh, you
went on tape and then you flew.
Yes, I did, because I got the whole script, lots of scripts, and this was just one of seven or something that I was reading that week. Mm-hmm. And I remember finishing it and going into the kitchen, and my flatmate at the time, a guy called Nikesh Patel, who was in the terrible Four Weddings that I did. Great. Love Nikesh. And he was like, "Are you okay? You look kind of fried." So I've just read this amazing script, and it's of the pile of really bad pilots, this is the only one that I really want, and there's no way I'm going to get it. I know that I won't get it, because it was the sort of part that I would never ever have been cast in London. If it was an English production, I would never have got that part. I was like, but I love it. And I read him a bit, and it was a bit. In the pilot, obviously, you do scripts without thinking about the budget. And there was a helicopter flies in. It was the scene that was eventually, it was John Cho arresting me with the police car. Yeah. But it was a helicopter coming in. And we then spent an hour just pissing ourselves thinking of different ways to react to a helicopter, which was mainly high-pitched screaming and faint. So it's lucky that it was cut. And then I read it immediately again, which I don't really do with scripts very often because I loved it. Then I went on tape one wet Wednesday morning, and I saw a couple of the actors who went in before me, and they were all a lot older than I was, 30 at the time, and they were in their 40s. And I was like, they're going to go for big, gruff, 40-year-old, hardened-looking men. So I went in and I did my Bryan Cranston impression for the American bit, and did my fruity old Meissen for the British bit, and forgot about it. That was it.
It's funny because Tom and I were texting the other day. You texted me we were texting about my roommate, Melissa. And what's funny about this, and the reason I bring this up is she knew exactly who you were because she loves British television and British movies. And when I was being sent the various, reels or what have you, you came up and she's like, oh, he's great. I mean, she like rattled off a bunch of your credits, and my apologies. I didn't know you at the time. But I'm sorry.
You knew Melissa at the time?
Sure.
Wow, you guys have been friends forever.
So she... Yes.
This is what the people are tuning in for, guys.
So, yeah, exactly.
Chat about your flatmates.
But long story short, the reason I bring this up is because I remember seeing the reel. I remember thinking that you were great. I remember that people were like, he needs to grow a beard. I remember that because you were just very clean and you looked very young.
And the thing is, I always have a beard. My wife hates me without the beard. And I remember saying to her, I'm so sorry, I should probably trim it down for this audition. And so I did that just for the audition and hated it.
Oh, wow.
And then you grew it, and they said, grow it so that when you get here for the camera test, you'll have, and you had some gruff. You didn't have what you have now, but you had and I remember, we all remember, when you tested with Nicole, and it was like pretty instantaneous. Yeah, there was something there that was just really
They said, grow your beard and bring like a big military coat. Yeah. Yeah. And I had a big military coat, but with buttons missing. Mm-hmm. And I was going to fly out 2 days after getting the call.
Yeah.
And they sent me it was a 5-hour screen test, wasn't it? So there were four.
You tested by yourself.
Fucking loads. Yeah. There was loads to learn. And instead of learning it, I spent the entire 2 days and the flight looking for buttons that matched the buttons I had on the coat. I couldn't find buttons that matched, so I just bought 6 new buttons that look vaguely military, and then spent the flight, the 11-hour flight,
sewing,
cutting off the buttons and sewing new buttons on. And then landed in LA, and it was like, well, shit, I have no idea of my lines. I'll get straight to the hotel.
Right.
And start learning my lines. And walked out of the walked out of the airport.
So faster.
I'm a very good show.
It's an 11-hour flight.
I mean, I may have exaggerated that a little bit.
I'm not a great sewer, but that's not gonna take me 11 hours, I promise.
I got to the airport and in my head, everyone who comes over, who is called over for a screen test, I'd never done it before. And I thought, you get out of the airport and there's a stretch limo with a glass of champagne in the back and someone will pick you up. I turn up and I'm like, I have no idea how to get to my hotel. There's no car. Yeah. And I had, from a previous trip to America, I had about $7 in my pocket. And so I don't know the address of the hotel, and I can't get a taxi because I have zero money in my bank. And so I went to the ATM to try and get money out get a taxi. And it was like, you've been doing fucking theater for 4 years. And I was skinned. And couldn't get to the hotel. And it was, then it was about 8 in the evening. And I had to get my big military coat on.
I remember
my suitcase. Someone had to give me directions to the nearest bus terminal to LAX. Oh, and God. I remembered vaguely where the hotel was from the last time I was in LA. I couldn't drive, so I was getting buses everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I remembered the bus, and I think it was 13 something, that went straight past Century City. And I knew that that's where the hotel was. And I knew that it ended in Santa Monica. And I knew the point that the bus stop is. So I had to go to a bus terminal, try and find the bus that would take me to Santa Monica, then try and find, using the power of my brain, the right bus stop, and get on another bus and go to... And by then I had like 4 hours before it was time to
go. I do remember... obviously, I remember the test. I remember you tested by yourself first without Nicole. Then you and I went for lunch on the at the commissary.
Yeah.
And I remember, which was lovely. We talked about David Bowie and Radiohead, and it was lovely.
That's right.
And then you tested with Nicole for us. We thought it was great. We recorded that, and then we showed that to the network a few days later. And they obviously were like, this is great.
It wasn't a few days later, because I remember leaving and thinking, nah, didn't get it.
Really? It. Maybe it
was. Yeah, I was convinced. I was convinced. I don't remember. And so I went down, because I was due to fly back home the next day. And so I left and I was like, well, it's been fun. It's been an experience. I got to see the buses again. And I had a really nice time doing the test. Fine. So well, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to do what you're not allowed to do as an actor in LA. I'm going to go out and I'm going to get absolutely shit-faced and have a burger and fries. And, you know. And just as I was taking a bite into my burger, I got a call from my agent saying, you've been offered it. And you're not going home tomorrow, and we need your passport, and you're going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina in 10 days.
And so I want to tell one very funny story about when we were shooting the pilot. It was a couple days in, and I remember, generally speaking, Kenny, you know this, but generally speaking, cast is shuttled back and forth from the hotel to set, you know, whatever. And a couple days in, you came up to me and you were like, hey, do you want to drive me to set? Like, do you want to just like, we'll just listen to music, we'll go to set.
Yeah,
together.
It was like an hour long drive up to.
Yeah, and I was just like, and I was like, yeah, absolutely, I would love to do that. So I drive you to set, and then I get to set, and one of the producers takes me aside and is like, you can't just take the lead actor. You can't just like, you know, kidnap him and go wherever you want with him. Like, he has to be at a certain place at a certain time. So that was one of the lessons that I learned shooting this. But I do have a question for you.
That's a Teamster issue right there. You're running afoul of some people you don't want to foul of.
Yeah. My question to you is this. When this project comes to you, did you watch the movie? Did you think about the Johnny Depp performance?
Say, yes.
Did this influence you in any way, shape, or form? Interesting. No. So you didn't want to be... You didn't want to be influenced by it?
No, mainly because in the UK, we don't really, we don't read the book. Because it's not, you know, I understand why it's considered classic in America and then, you know. But no, you mentioned Sleepy Hollow and people just go, Johnny Depp.
Right.
Johnny Depp. And so if I say there's a TV show based on Sleepy Hollow, I'm like, oh, are you Johnny Depp? Are you Johnny Depp? It's, you know, that's their big boots.
Well, so I want to unpack this in the sense that I want to talk about the role of Ichabod Crane and sort of in the Disney film, he is this weird, tall, lanky teacher with like a receding hairline and a giant nose, and he just looks like
I've only seen that since doing the
right
show.
So that is the Ichabod Crane that most people associated prior to this movie coming out. Then this movie comes out. Johnny Depp apparently specifically asked that he wanted to do the makeup. He wanted a giant nose. He wanted the receding hairline. He wanted all this shit. And the studio was like, no, we paid for Johnny Depp's face and we're not interested in caking it in some weird shit. So he wasn't able to hide behind his usual accoutrement that he's so adept at doing. But then this becomes Ichabod Crane, right? Like this is the Johnny Depp's performance for all intents and purposes really becomes sort of the definition of the role. So,
I guess in America, this overtook the cartoon, did it?
The cartoon persists only as a ride at Disneyland and Disney World. Mr. Toad's Wild Ride is a ride people go on, and it's a ride that's been there for 50 plus years. As a film, it is not important in the Disney canon. Nobody shows this film to people.
Well, because it's a short too, right? Like I think it was clumped with something else. I think there were like two things that it was part of. I could be totally wrong.
I don't know, but to be honest with you, Phil, I never even considered showing it to my kids, and they they have seen everything. So
but it does feel like Johnny's performance certainly is like the thing, right? Now,
the other thing I want to say about Sleepy Hollow in general is I grew up 15 minutes from Sleepy Hollow, from the town of Sleepy Hollow. It was called something different when I was, I forgot what it was called when I was a kid.
It is called something else. Hold on.
Well, it used to be. It's not Ossining, which still exists, but it was called something different. And then around 99 or so, they changed the name back to Sleepy Hollow. And even as someone who grew up 15 minutes.
Tarrytown is what it was in the village of Tarrytown. Tarrytown still exists,
but North Tarrytown might have been what it was, and North Tarrytown might have changed their name to Sleepy Hollow. Correct. To capitalize on this. But even as someone who lived 15 minutes, this was not something we learned. This was not local lore. It's not even a thing. It's certainly not a book we read. It's something you're vaguely aware of. Like the Headless Horseman is a Halloween character, much like Michael Myers is a Halloween character.
See, I always thought that the book was kind of one of those school books that everyone is made to read. Really?
Definitely not. No. Not when you're young, not when you're old, but maybe around Halloween.
And yet, the Headless Horseman is such an enduring
character, Ichabod Crane, which is such an interesting name. It's a name that obviously stands out. You've got Rip Van Winkle as well, which is also an interesting name. Like, I do think that Washington Irving unintentionally stumbled across these weird iconic things.
Yeah, they're kind of this, American lore that kind of exists the way Paul Bunyan exists or Johnny Appleseed exists. These aren't things that you ever read. They're just kind of things that you're aware of,
Yep, totally. And I think that, so I mean, back to sort of my original question to you, Tom, which is you saw this film in 99. Do you want to relay to us the story of seeing this film in 99?
In the cinema. One of the few films.
In Woking?
The only of the films that we've done. Not in Woking. I went to see it in Richmond in London. And with Emily Blunt, who I was at school with, and I had no idea whether it was a date. I didn't think it was a date, but I've since found out it may well have been a date. I had no
idea.
It's
your sliding doors moment, Tom. That's your moment. Oh, man. You know it, but like...
Well, it shows quite how bad I always was with girls. We went out for dinner and a film. And I didn't know if it was a date or not. But I do remember I sat on a fruit pastel and ruined my trousers. And that, honestly, is the enduring thought whenever anyone mentions Sleepy Hollow for the film. Even doing the show, anyone mentions Sleepy Hollow, I think, I loved those trousers.
That's fantastic. So did Emily like the film? Do you remember if you guys...
I remember we both enjoyed the film. I loved Tim Burton at the time. I was really obsessed with Tim Burton.
Well, this also has a deep bench of British actors, of tremendous British actors.
The best.
So, which is part of this whole sort of, milieu that Burton is playing in with this film, which is that it is sort of this old Hammer film styled film in terms of having this like kind of a whodunit at the center of it and a sort of murder mystery mixed into it.
Yeah, people tend to think of Burton as being kind of horror light horror, but actually this is really the only one of his films that is actively a horror.
Well, I think that you're tapping into something that I think is interesting, which is the misnomer of gothic and horror. Those are two different things. Right. And I think that he's definitely a gothic filmmaker who loves the aesthetic that comes with that, but he's not like he even says it himself, like, this is my first horror film. And quite honestly, I think it's last. If you consider Sweeney Todd a horror film, I don't know. But it does feel like he was dipping his toes into something that he had never done before. But it is interesting how, watching this again yesterday, and I don't know if you felt this way, Kenny, but like, it's a very bloody movie. I mean, it is a horror film, you know, in terms of, it's not scary, but it is playing in horror tropes, and it is playing in that sort of Hammer horror films, obviously, of that period.
And then you cast, you know, Christopher Lee and Michael Goff, and, you know, then you've got...
Yes. And Michael Chambon and like Richard Griffiths. And it's just like, you've got this crazy... Anyway, sorry, go ahead, Kenny.
No, I don't know. It's a horror film, I guess.
Thank you.
But it's too lush. It's too lush to be scary.
It's beautiful. It's too beautiful.
The production value is there's too much money being spent, and it is too well done and beautiful to actually be scary. I know that sounds like weird. Like
there are scary moments.
Like there's a couple jump scares.
Jump scares, fine.
Yeah.
But it was when, after the first time he sees the horseman, I think it was, and they're walking back across the bridge.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they hear the footsteps behind him. Yeah. And he's not there. And then suddenly he's on top. That was my favorite moment. Yeah. I loved that. And that was genuinely scary. And a lot more than, you know, hacking and...
The blood is so unrealistic looking, intentionally so. Like, it does feel as though they're...
Apparently, Tom Stoppard came in to doctor the script.
He did it specifically to make it... Uncredited rewrite. Yeah.
Yes, but with particular emphasis on bringing down the violence.
Yes. Andrew Kevin Walker's script, which I have not read, but I can only assume, considering what he also wrote in 1999, Fight Club and 8mm, my assumption is that it was a dark movie. And I think that, yes, I think that once Tim Burton came in, this is the other thing too, where it's like, Tim Burton's still kind of, you know, a four quadrant filmmaker. Like, he's not an idiot. He still wants to make movies for as many people as he possibly can. So like, he knows that Andrew Kevin Walker's Sleepy Hollow script is not going to cut it. Like, that's not going to get where I need to go. But I also think what's interesting too is as is the case with Burton, certainly, you know, spotty here and there, but he's an homage filmmaker, right? Like, if you look at Ed Wood, Ed Wood is obviously a Valentine to Ed Wood. Mars Attacks is basically an Ed Wood movie if he got $50 million to make a movie. This is a Hammer film love letter to all those horror films that he loved as a kid. So like, because there's that loving kind of quality that you're talking about, Kenny, it makes it less scary, right? Like, there's too much care being put
into it. And then you add something brilliantly, Burton, where when a head's cut off, it spins round. It spins round on the head before falling off, which I think is brilliant. And that's such a good way. If you don't want it to be too gruesome, you add just a little element of Burton gothic cartoon.
Yeah. Totally.
There are two things at work here that, you know, a grown-up knows going into this movie. One is what we're saying. Mm-hmm. It's both what they're saying. It's the Tim Burton element, and it's the way it looks. And you know from the moment you're going in that they're not going to fuck you up. This isn't the Texas Chainsaw Massacre where you turn that on and you think, I could be fucked up. Like, this could fuck up my night or my life. But totally. You know, you don't know. And that's the thrill of it for me, which is like, I kind of want my life to be fucked up. But with Sleepy Hollow, you go in and, you know, like, look, this movie, what it made,
$200 million.
It made $200 million for a
reason.
What was the budget? 70. So one sheet.
It's a PG-13 movie. I mean, Rollins is, I mean, my son is such a nut. He's literally sitting there with his phone looking up, and he goes, well, all right, this says it's for 12 plus. Like, I'll be fine. He's nine. He said, this is for 12 plus. Like, I guess I will lower myself and watch this child movie with you, Dad.
I do want to very quickly give a synopsis for the people who haven't seen Sleepy Hollow. It's set in 1799 based on Washington Irving's classic
like they're
tale.
They're still listening.
They're listening. Ichabod Crane is sent to Sleepy Hollow to the decapitations of three people, with the culprit being the legendary apparition, the Headless Horseman. Sleepy Hollow opened on November 19th, 1999, in second place behind The World Is Not Enough. I'm assuming you all saw that opening weekend, Tom. I can only assume.
I did.
Maybe? I'm sure you did.
Yeah, I did.
And ahead of Pokemon, The Bone Collector, and Dogma. That's a murderer's row right there. That's a really interesting weekend.
We've done them all.
We've done them all. It would go on to make $207 million on a $70 million budget. It has 69% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 80% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 3.5 stars, saying Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow begins with a story that would not have distinguished one of the lesser films from the Hammer horror franchise and elevates it to sheer style and acting into something entertaining and sometimes rather elegant. The best-looking horror film since Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. What it depends upon is Burton's gift for effects and a superb performance by Johnny Depp, who discards everything we may have ever learned or thought about it from scratch. The ending is perhaps too traditional. Burton at least doesn't linger over this or exploit it. He's too much in love with his moody setup to ruin the fun with final overkill. The most astonishing thing for me about the movie wasn't the horseman anyway, but the fact that I actually found myself drawn into this old classics illustrated material, enthralled by a time and place so well evoked that the horseman almost seemed natural there. Then he has a note at the end of his review where he says, "No power on earth could drag from me the identity of the unbilled actor who plays the horseman when he has a head. You will agree he is the only logical choice." Which I'm like... Okay, I mean, Chris Watkins inspired casting, but
great
overplaying your hand. Great.
Yeah.
If you're going to have an actor who isn't going to say a word, but is going to bring so much to the very end when he throws Miranda onto the front of his horse.
And the bite with the blood, the kiss.
The bite with the blood, but before that, the sort of, it's threatening, but it's sexually suggestive. Coming with me. It's so much in one look, and it's genuinely brilliant. I have no idea how he did it, and no one else other than Walken could do that.
It's fantastic.
Max Shrek Walken.
Oh, like the best.
Him leaning into that wild-eyed, wild-haired thing that he's allowed. That Pete, I think that's really what to do. But
well, you know, it's what I love about this is he's cast as this horseman, gets to set and says, "I don't know how to ride a horse." So,
is that true?
It's true. So all of his
is that horses, a shock?
It's not a surprise to me, but I just love that. To be perfectly honest, it actually works. Style of it. When you see that flashback of him and he's on horseback and he's like, you know, slashing away at all those soldiers. It's all silhouette basically anyway. It doesn't matter that he's on a hobby horse or he's on some sort of a fucking whatever. Like it doesn't matter. And it's just, I don't know. I think it adds to the style of it. I think it adds to the campiness that exists with this, the tone that Burton's trying to do. Time Magazine says something which is that Burton's richest, prettiest, weirdest film since Batman Returns. The simple story bends to his twist, freeing him for an extra. I do think that this is, and I forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think the film of his that has ever won an Academy Award. It won Best Production Design, as it rightly should. It's one of the most exquisite looking films I've ever seen, even to this day. Almost 90% of this film was shot on sound stages. So if you think about a horse at full gallop, running inside.
Yes, I remember someone during Sleepy Hollow telling me that they built the entire forest in the biggest soundstage in the world in London.
In London.
And they built a track in a circle so that you can pop the camera right in the middle and have the horseman leading it around this circle. Yeah. And if you follow it in the right way, then it's doing a tracking shot, a straight.
That's incredible.
So brilliant.
It's completely inspired.
I mean, part of this too is Emmanuel Lubezki shoots this film, who is obviously one of the greatest cinematographers that's ever been. And, you know, so for him, I imagine this was just a blast, right? He got to play in a whole new sandbox with all the toys and all the stuff that he wanted to do. But it's all forced perspective. Whenever you've got these big wide shots of the hills and what have you, it's all smoke and forced perspective. So it looks like it's just this gargantuan thing that it's not. Really the only exteriors are of the town, which they built in like the woods or out in, you know, wherever the hell they built it. It's just an exquisite, and the costumes, like everything about this to me is just, you know, anyone who works in Below the Line, this is just a heralded movie.
Which is why it's so successful. I think it's entirely down to that. Because when you've got something silly as a headless horseman and the type of story that they're doing, you have to be completely, you have to create a very real world. Even though it's in a heightened gothic world, you believe it. And it's very telling that I've got my little notepad.
Yeah.
Which I've been doing. I've got all of the podcast like it ones that we've done. Starting back.
You could put it in our podcast like it's museum somewhere.
Yeah. And for this film, I've got like one page because I just completely lost myself in it.
Yeah, I know. It's a swift 100 minutes. It doesn't overstay its welcome. There's always something happening. It always feels as though there's a twist or a turn or there's something. And perhaps, you know, to your ultimate point, it pulls you in. The world is so beautiful and captivating that you're just sucked into it that it's hard not to just, it flies by. It really does.
I'll never get bored of fruity old Brits giving guilty looks at each other.
There's a lot of them in this. There's so many pregnant pauses and looks towards its
crazy. And when you give that to like Gambon and you know, Richard Griffiths, they're gonna chew it up.
There's so many obviously great moments in this, but I think Gambon's death is one of my favorites because he's in a church, he's standing on this pulpit, he's screaming about conspiracy and that someone's coming for him, and then a fucking picket fence flies through the stained glass window through his chest and just pulls him right out of the fucking church. And he's just like, you can tell that all of them are having so much fun, just absolutely hamming it up. They're all just
This is the thing is when you have a script like this and you know it's a director like Tim Burton and you know that it's going to have, Danny Elfman making it sound amazing basically he's going to make it look amazing. Yeah. You could get any actor in the world. There's not a single actor in the world who wouldn't want to be a part of it.
So before we dive into the plot and get to our Tim Burton picks, I want to ask you about a question that was sort of, as I was watching Sleepy Hollow, I was thinking about it, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this. It's sort of the idea of the tactile versus the CGI, right? Like, this movie is incredibly tactile, right? Obviously, there's some CG effects of a horse diving out of a tree, for instance, or Chris Walken's face, what have you. But, what did you guys, and actually, Kenny, I'm curious as to what if your son even tracked this as well, but like that idea of there's a generation of people, of kids now that like nothing is fucking built, right? Like it's everything is in front of a fucking green screen. So did he clock the fact that like this was a forest and this was a horse and like all this stuff was like real? Did you guys feel like it had... it's one of the things I love about this movie, but I guess I'm just wondering what you guys felt about it.
I don't remember. I could speak kind of generally because I remember my son not saying anything about it.
Right.
And he is a smart aleck in that he will immediately call out bad CG. He'll immediately call out bad practical effects. He really gets off on that. And that is not what happened watching this film. So
that says something.
It's always more satisfying, but it might be because, you know, we're of the generation that didn't have good CG. But Tim, because I was thinking about it, watching it, that Tim Burton and Terry Gilliam are two examples of directors who work so much better when they don't have CG.
I was thinking
when they...
Yeah.
when they have to be creative and artistic and have it there, it's infinitely better and infinitely more suited.
So
to
much
their,
better.
Their style.
Because there's a lot of people that feel like this is the movie, the last great Tim Burton movie, right? Like that he kind of goes off of a cliff at this point because, I mean, Alice in Wonderland is an abomination of a movie. And part of it is because you're just inundated with this very fake looking world in a way that is just feels antithetical to his work. Like that's what's so interesting to me is that I guess, I mean, even Dumbo, which I think is maybe the best iteration of that for him, but still it's just like it's missing that tangible kind of feeling.
Yeah, and actually we watched, my son and I, he's six, mm-hmm. not that long ago, we watched Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Sure.
The film. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite books, and the film is, you know, it's not the book or the TV series or the radio show. It's at the bottom of the Hitchhiker's list. But we loved it, and we loved it because the, you know, the Vogons are there. They're people that they built the suits, and Marvin is there walking around with them. And so my son was obsessed with it because of that. He loved that you can tell that there's people in a room with a depressed robot, and that's a lot funnier and a lot better than if it was, you know, a CG one. Also, just look at The Mandalorian. Most popular character in genre of the last 5-10 years, and it's Baby Yoda. And you might know this story, but he was going to be CG Baby Yoda, mm-hmm. and only fractionally they'd have the little mm-hmm. puppet. And it was the first time, Baby Yoda's first outing was with Werner Herzog in one of his scenes. And they said, halfway through, they did his stuff. And they said, okay, get rid of the puppet and bring in the balls and we'll do CG. And Herzog was like, what? And stopped them. He was like, what the fuck are you doing? And they said, well, it's going to be mainly CG. It's this puppet. Sure. And he went berserk. And called them fucking cowards, is his exact words. If you're doing CG, you're fucking cowards. And persuaded them to do the whole thing.
That's fantastic. That's the best thing. That's fantastic.
I want to get into this a little more mm-hmm. because sure. this is this is kind of fascinating too. I love him,
Werner,
the hero. God bless him. But I'm a little fascinated by this because what you're saying is, you know, demonstrably true. Burton's work falls off right around this point, you know? And like, you know, look, Planet of the Apes was not CG. Planet of the Apes was pretty tactile as well, but
Phil, that face, the mention of Planet of the Apes, your face. Because
it's the moment when I was like, oh no, what
But happened? There's something here that I want to kind of hone in on, which is, it's not the practical effects and the physical costumes that make Burton's work work. Mm-hmm. It's the stories. There's something else going on here. So why can't he also find a good script or a workable, exciting script that works in CG? We've all seen films that rely heavily on CG, including movies in 1999, that are incredible, that work really well. So what is it about Burton that makes it? Because it's not just that you can't touch it.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's we all know that what ends up on the screen is often wildly different to what is on mm-hmm. the page. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing CG, you have to hand it over to other people. You explain it as best as you can, but at the end of the day, it's people with a computer. Whereas Tim Burton, who has always been an artist and, you know, drawn and made things, if it's practical and it's there, he can work it.
Yeah.
And he has complete control. So it's definitely his story being told in the way that he wants it to tell, rather than people, you know, you get the wrong guy.
That's a really excellent point.
I think it's very much. I think that's I think that's absolutely
true. You answered
true.
The and question I think that perfectly.
I think that the fulcrum point for him is actually Mars Attacks, which is that he wanted the Martians to be stop motion. And Warner Brothers was like, no.
Really?
Give it a shot.
They're kind of cowardly.
Yeah,
but
no, they threw a MacBook at him and said, "Nah, you're using this."
But I think the aliens in or the Martians in Mars Attacks are fantastic. They're the best part of that movie, and I think that ultimately, you know, when push comes to shove, that was the moment when he was like, "Oh, wait a second, I can do stuff I want to do with computer generated effects." Then he goes and he develops, because, I mean, as I'm sure you guys know, maybe you don't know, he spent many years developing Superman Lives. He was supposed to make a Superman movie with Nicolas Cage playing Superman. There's a whole documentary and footage of it. And if you haven't seen it, you should see it because it's real weird. And I don't know what that movie was going to be. But it was going to be a lot of CG. And it was going to be a very sort of, it was going to his most overtly sci-fi thing. It might have been the end of his career, quite frankly. I'm not sure that movie would have worked. But that movie hits the skids, and he basically jumps into Sleepy Hollow immediately after that, which is the exact opposite. And I think there's something to be said for a guy who spent 2 years developing a movie that was going to be mostly computer generated into a Hammer film love letter to those horror films that's entirely on sound stages, that has very little computer generated effects, and that it is one of his best films, because I think, to what you guys are saying, there is a love for him being like, I can see this, I can touch this, I understand this in a way that maybe he doesn't with CGI. And Alice in Wonderland being the prime example of what happens when he just goes way too far down the other road. But to your point, Kenny, I agree with you. A story is a story is a story.
Yeah. Well,
but,
no, I think Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is pretty revolting as well.
For many reasons.
Like truly, like, physically difficult to, like, stomach. Yeah. a lot of that is due to the copious use of CGI when it shouldn't have been. But
and Johnny Depp's performance, which was apparently inspired by Michael Jackson and Oscar Wilde.
Yeah, who he definitely hung out with Oscar Wilde.
it's ridiculous.
Also,
what a pretentious thing.
Because Burton has such a distinct style and such a look. And I mean, the fact that you can describe things as Burton-esque, there aren't very many people who actually have their own word. So, from an actor's point of view, to be able to actually inhabit that world is brilliant. And so that's what, watching Sleepy Hollow, I thought, how fun to actually go and be in the village. He gets to design a village, and the village is built, and there's a guy running around, you know, dressed as the head of horseman, and that's what you don't want to be in front of it. A green screen.
Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, obviously as an actor, not to ask an obvious question, but like, it doesn't compare, right? I mean, like, when you have to just imagine something in front of you as opposed to seeing the fucking thing, like, there's just no question what you would prefer.
Yeah, easily.
So in terms of the actors, Johnny Depp was always the first choice, but the studio...
I just want to ask one more kind of general question about the CGI versus physical locations. Could he do it today? Because the story is now there is a two-part question. Story is always what you just said in terms of Mars Attacks. He wants to do it a certain way. The studio demands that it's CG. Okay, so if we assume that the studio would allow it, which is its own question, would the public accept it? Would a public accept a Sleepy Hollow-esque or Ed Wood-esque Edward Scissorhands-esque world?
I think so.
Why don't we try is I guess my question.
Because probably the answer to the first bit of the question, whether the studio would allow it, is no.
I think that if tomorrow, if this version didn't exist and Tim Burton went to a studio today and said, I want to make a Sleepy Hollow movie, I think he probably could still do what he wants to do. This movie's budget, which is on the higher end of things, I think ultimately he still would have got it made. I think to your grander or your greater point, Kenny, is that 99.9% of this industry wouldn't allow it to get made. I think that the probably the closest thing that I can think of recently is The Green Knight. You know, David Lowery was given, you know, $20, $30 million to make a pretty alienating film about a knight.
I thought he got a lot more money than that, but
maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know how much it got in terms of budget, but it's a gorgeous film. Love that it exists. I actually think that, Blank Check did an episode on Sleepy Hollow, and David Lowery was their guest on that episode. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Like, I think that Sleepy Hollow is definitely a touchstone for Green Knight in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But that's an anomaly, to your point, Kenny. Right? Like, The Green Knight, the reason, one of the reasons why people are so excited about it is because it feels so unlike anything out there right now.
I was right. It's not 20 to 30. It's only 15. So, right again over here. Lowery,
just like your wife.
Interestingly enough, David Lowery had a really great use of CG in Pete's Dragon.
That really
does kind of meet you in the middle, and that dragon feels like a real creature. So, you know, he's a special filmmaker in his own right, but
for sure. And I think that, I mean, not to state the obvious, but I do think that A24 as a studio is going out of its way to nurture these types of voices, nurture these people that are trying to make films that, quite frankly, we were making far more often 20, 30 years ago. But I do think it's interesting, Kenny. You're not wrong. We're not trying,
a bunch of cowards.
We are a bunch of cowards. I mean, just look at what J.J. Abrams did with the first. I mean, he was adamant that the first Star Wars, that Force Awakens, have as much, you know, practical effects as possible, practical makeup, practical creatures. And they pushed back on it. And they were just like, but it's like they learned nothing from the prequels. But anyway, I digress. I wanted to mention some of the actors that the studio essentially, I don't want to say forced, but wanted Tim Burton to talk with about Ichabod. Liam Neeson, Brad Pitt, and Daniel Day-Lewis. Very much would have loved to have seen Daniel Day-Lewis's Ichabod Crane. Sure, would have been here for it.
Brad Pitt too.
But obviously, I think it was always going to be Johnny Depp. I don't think that anybody questioned that. I want to kind of, let's jump through the plot here a little bit. People know The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. There's not a tremendous amount of stuff we need to talk about in terms of the plot, but there's some things that I did kind of want to talk about a little bit. I want to talk about the opening portion of this film, which was a studio note and was not how the film originally opened. The film originally opened with Ichabod in New York finding the body before he gets sent to Sleepy Hollow. So that whole Martin Landau opening, who's great, Martin Landau should be in everything, or rest in peace, but you know my point. That whole opening was because they wanted essentially a cold open for a television show, right? Like, they wanted a cool opening that saw the horseman, that saw somebody get beheaded, and they sort of retroactively added that in there. What I love about it is it's a silent movie. Like, the first, like, 7 to 10 minutes of the film are just and bordering on black and white as well. I mean, this movie's very monochromatic, intentionally so, but it's beautifully shot. That whole opening, I just absolutely adore. And obviously, you know, the Martin Landau thing is a nice nod to Ed Wood and what have you. But what did you guys think of the opening?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I didn't know that it was an option to have not started with that.
Yeah, right,
to have started with him in New York, because that would make no sense. it would have been a boring way to start. Totally. Whereas if you're going into this, you know, brilliantly imaginative world, mm-hmm. go straight in at the deep end.
Totally.
And then go into a little bit of the fucking character stuff.
I don't know about you guys, but I love a movie that doesn't give me a title until a good 10 minutes into the film.
Oh, me too.
Yes, me too. The later, the better. When a movie title comes up at the end of a film before the credits,
also
I find that
also
deeply satisfying.
You're like, that's what I just watched.
That is a great feeling. That's such a triumphant feeling when the title only comes up when the movie ends. You're like, yeah. I watched the first episode of Squid Game, I wanted that, but instead I just shouted, Squid Game!
Amazing. So we get to Sleepy Hollow. We meet our whole cast of characters. We have a great scene where Ichabod meets all of the various nefarious British actors that they've decided to put all in one room. And it's like Clue. It's like he's just sitting there and he's doing like Columbo as he's walking around them and pretending like he's, I think it's fantastic. I imagine the Tom Stoppard stuff of the fact that anytime there's a shot of a book or the inside of a book, it's basically telling you everything that's about to come ahead from. Like, it's all just like, if you're paying attention to anything, we're telling you everything as it's about to come. Then we get the flashback of Chris Walken as the horseman, which is great, with his sharpened teeth.
Great
and
teeth.
All of it's just great. Obviously, we see the little girl breaking the stick, which calls back, obviously, at the end when we realize who that little girl is. We talked a little bit about this, but I want to underline it again just one more time. Every time we see a horse running a full gallop, it is inside a soundstage. Now, I don't
know if
you guys have been in a soundstage, but it's the idea of it is terrifying to me because it's not that big a space. Like, if you're lucky, it's relatively big, but it's filled with all these stages. So like it's not, or sets and what have you. So it's really not that spacious. The idea of a horse running full gallop down a soundstage is terrifying to me, but I think it's amazing. We should talk a little about Ichabod's steampunky kind of component. His goggles.
That was actually one of the few notes that I put. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's where it got. That was a Burtonism too far for me.
Okay.
I mean, it's since become, you know, iconic. It's the image of the film is him with those big. And there was another example later on, but it kind of sticks out when you've got this really really weird world.
Yeah,
you don't need to then add on something. It didn't seem right. It seemed like.
It's a little hat and a hat.
Was a bit of a joke, you know.
Yeah, it definitely feels like, wouldn't it be cool? And then you're like, but would it?
You know, because everything else is cool enough. They don't need. Yeah. I've never heard the saying "hat on a hat," but you're right. It's that. Mm-hmm.
It's yeah.
You only need one hat.
And that's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that hat works. Yeah, I tend to agree with you. This time around, I did find myself. There's also like, it's revealed too. Like they make a big. He kind of goes down and he pulls them back on his face in such an exaggerated fashion that you're just like, all right, like
you know, they were doing it and they could picture a cinema full of people pissing themselves. That was definitely a Groucho Marx little holding his cigar and raising his eyebrows at the camera. Type moment.
It definitely feels that way for sure. The other, I think one of the most iconic images, I would say from Sleepy Hollow just across the board is the pumpkin on fire being thrown at him. Mm-hmm. It's such a great, like it's the whole thing, right? Like that is, if you're thinking about Sleepy Hollow, that's the thing. The flashbacks, I'm curious what you guys thought about the flashbacks of young Ichabod.
Well, listen. I can tell you that when you've got a character like Ichabod Crane, don't fuck about with family stuff.
Like James Bond. Don't tell me about James Bond's parents. I don't care.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or especially or if Freddy, anyone or in the Freddy family Krueger's. Are
witches, you know.
Exactly.
Don't do it.
I will say that seeing Lisa Marie in this really hammers home that Tim Burton's got a type. You've got Lisa Marie.
Yeah.
You've got Helena Bonham Carter. Now Ava Green. Like, it's just like, we get it, man. Like, you definitely,
I also kind of think they conform to a type. I don't know if Ava Green was that before she got into the, you know, no, the Burton game.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, she was like, okay, so this is the role I have to play now.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you've seen the pictures of Brad Pitt with all his girlfriends, how he's like human tofu and just becomes his girlfriends.
He just copies his girlfriends. Human tofu is the greatest thing I've ever heard. I've never heard that before. Really is. It's crazy.
I use it to describe one of my children. I won't tell you which one.
Oh boy. All right. So I have a question for you, Tom, about Johnny's performance. Do you feel that it is, like, I think it's a funny performance, right? Like, I think when he's leaning into the cowardly, I'm a coward, I'm scared of my own shadow, he faints like 10 times in this movie. What are your feelings about it? Do you think it's a little too much? Like, No. It doesn't bother me necessarily, but I'm just curious as to what you think.
No, I think it's pretty well placed, because it's tricky that he's, you know, his Ichabod is bright going into a world that he doesn't quite believe in.
Yeah.
But at the center of, if you're doing it according to the book, he's a coward. But you can't be a cowardly detective. It doesn't really work. Wouldn't work. So ignoring the cowardice for a bit and focusing on he's just someone who's perpetually puzzled and trying to work things out, and then just allowing the cowardice to come out through fainting really well as well.
He keels over a lot of spins and falls.
It's brilliant. And then that's everything that you need to know about him. Mm-hmm. It's not that he's a scaredy cat. It's just that his body switches off.
Love
when something frightening happens.
The moment when the headless horseman flies out of the tree, when he sees the tree open up, the tree of the dead or the tree of death or whatever they're calling it, and the horseman literally like
tree of souls.
Tree of souls, tree of the, yeah, anyway. It makes me think about a moment when we were working on the pilot of the show, because I remember it was myself and Bob and Alex and Len, and we were sitting there, and I can't remember if it was Alex or Bob, but one of them wanted the horseman to kind of breach out of the water, like basically just like to literally like fly out of the water thing. And I remember Len saying, yeah, that's a movie idea, that's not a TV idea. Which I just think is, I mean, and it does show the difference, right? Like, I mean, putting all of the streaming stuff aside and the budgets that a lot of these shows get nowadays, it is interesting that like television is just more intimate. It's smaller. That's not a bad thing, but like you can't do some of these crazy effects things that at least on broadcast. But
I mentioned earlier we had in the original script there was a helicopter that comes in and chases.
Yes.
But there was a bit where the horseman rides his horse over a car.
Yeah.
Jumping over a police car, and you know
what did the helicopter become?
I think it was like a police cruiser that shoots at them.
It was a bike. It was a man on a bike.
Yeah, it was basically that. Yeah. I mean, one of the greatest things about working with Bob and Alex is that they just go for it, and they're just like, and then we'll do this and this. I'm like, listen, guys, if we can do it, let's do it. But I mean, crazy stuff.
My favorite Entourage story when we wrote in Leonardo DiCaprio, assuming we can get him, and went all the way down and wound up casting Queen Latifah.
If that's not a perfect distillation of Hollywood, I don't know what is.
Yep, that was season 7 on Entourage.
Wow.
The town really told us where we stood.
I want to talk about one of my favorite images of the whole movie. And it's one of the first things I remember seeing from the movie, which is that when the trailer dropped, there's a little boy and a lantern in his bedroom. And there's these beautiful shadows that are being cast from this lantern. It's like kind of like almost like a zoetrope. And you're seeing this horseman that's riding in the shadows all around his bedroom walls. And it's an exquisite image, even if it, you know, actually makes no fucking sense. Like if you look at it, you're like, he would be in the way of this. So like you couldn't actually physically have all of this stuff around. Like it actually doesn't logically make any sense.
But it is.
Yeah, there's no shadow of the mother and the son, but doesn't matter. Point is, that whole sequence is exquisite. The way that it's lit is just absolutely gorgeous. And it's still happening while the mother is getting killed and she's got this horseman that's cast across her as she's in the... and then just that shot of the little boy looking up and seeing his mother's dead eyes through the slit in the floor. Like, it's all really good shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then just, somehow the horseman then realizes that there's a boy.
It goes back and kills the kid.
Which then, again, that doesn't make a great deal of sense because later on he doesn't really know who's around and where, and he doesn't clock in the denouement where he's looking for someone and doesn't know where they are, but he's aware of a child, you know. But this world is that I don't care.
Don't care.
I'm a fucking pedant, but I don't care in this film.
Well, it's interesting. You are underlining one of the bigger logical issues, I think, which is the horseman is only there to kill the people that he needs to kill, right? That he's been told to kill. There's no reason
That's
to kill
what
the
I
kid.
Was thinking. Yes.
Like it's not a witness non-witness situation. It's about people that are know certain knowledge. The kid doesn't care if I have, so your point is completely valid. I think Tim Burton just wanted to kill a kid. That's what I think.
Maybe Miranda Richardson fucking hated that kid. So write him in the Death Note book.
I will say, as much as I'm not a fan of the Ichabod backstory, and it's funny, Kenny, you bring up Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, another person I don't want to know anything about. I don't need backstory on fucking Willy Wonka, and I don't need a prequel with Timothy Chalamet Willy Wonka.
He's so beautiful, though, isn't he?
He's a beautiful man. Mm-hmm. I'm not taking that away from him, but I don't need to see him.
So I've heard.
Is it just like...
So let him pop on his little hat and jump around, and I'll be happy with it.
You know,
that's what his agent said. Let him put on his little hat. Let him pop around.
That's acting, though, isn't it? That's life we choose. You pop on a hat and jump about a bit and have a wonderful time and then go home for a bath.
It's so hard to get a movie made.
Yep.
And it's so hard to nail the right thing for a reboot of a franchise or a reimagining of a franchise. And yet, this idea of let's take this, you know, ineffable character and learn about where he came from happens all the time.
All the time.
Like fucking James Franco playing young Wizard of Oz. Come on.
I'm with you, Kenny. We talked about this a little bit when the first image dropped, I think the other day, of Timothy dressed up as Willy Wonka, looking like with them, like just eye fucking the audience. I'm just like,
yeah, the Wonka who fucks.
The Wonka who fucks is what America apparently wants. Yeah. So that being said, I agree with you, Kenny. I'm just like, who wanted this?
Hard to reboot these things, and these are such lame ideas. I think the thought process is, and by the way, they'll do it with Ichabod too, but I think the thought process is if this succeeds, we have like 25 years of story before they get where they need to get. Yeah. But it never succeeds.
So when was the last big budget film that is an original IP? That you can think of.
Oh, Free Guy, the best one of them all.
But isn't that also just IP?
No, it's not.
I haven't seen it.
I've seen clips of that, and it's Deadpool again. It's a whole bunch of like references to a bunch of fucking things.
First of all, it's not references. Second of all, like that's ridiculous. You can't say it's IP because it's like other stuff. Everything's like something else. It is not IP. It is.
It literally has a lightsaber. Pre-sold. Does he not? At one point,
at the end of the movie, they reach into all of this Disney IP So because like they do in Fortnite or whatever, but that is not like for these weapons, but that's not what they're selling the movie on. And regardless, like the whole idea is it's not pre-sold. It's not a piece of IP. I don't know how else to put it.
Is it going to be the start of a franchise? Probably. But that's neither here nor there. I'm not really disagreeing with you on this specific instance, Kenny, but in terms of like something that is completely in no way, shape, or form, you know, some sort of is harder to find.
The thing is, and this is why I'm so into Free Guy, they try every year and they fail every year. And people on the internet are savage towards people who are actually trying to do things original, which is like my biggest fucking bete noir in this business.
Yeah.
You know, when people actually try to do things like, you know, sit in their room and come up with a spec and come up with an idea, and then it actually gets made and people just shit all over it. It really kills me.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, it's fucking hard to get it made. It's
fucking hard.
For sure. It's hard to even get someone to consider making it. And then once you get a group of people together and you actually fucking do something,
I'll give you an example of one that just came out. I haven't seen it, so this is, speaks nothing to its quality. But The Tomorrow War with Chris Pratt. That's a completely new idea, big budget movie. The kind of thing that if that's a success, you might wind up in a situation where you have more Terminators or more RoboCops or more things that like we actually grew up on that we love. But The Tomorrow War, people just, I think, without having a piece of IP to kind of go after or start discussing, people just started discussing how much they hate Chris Pratt and wanted him to go away. And this movie, you know, made absolutely no dent. Now I understand it was on, you know, it was in the pandemic.
It was on Amazon Prime.
Frankly, no one watches.
I'm afraid the pedant in me wouldn't shut up during that film.
Did you watch it? I
watched it, yeah.
Oh,
I watched it. Great. I watched it. I quite like Chris Pratt and Sacha Gabrielle, who was in Sleepy Hollow, was in it, and I think she's terrific. Mm. And the performances were great. But it made no sense to me.
Certainly allowed to hate the movie.
Time travel,
if it comes out.
Time travel. they have to be slightly better.
I don't really know what the movie's about, even. But you're allowed to certainly hate it. You have your subjective opinion, which is totally fine. But I root, as Phil knows, I root very hard for these like movies that get studios to spend $100 million for new ideas, and not even because I hate the franchises, just because I know those aren't going anywhere. And I also think
whenever I see something that's in the mid-budget range, the area that is almost extinct now. Mm-hmm. If I ever see a film in that, I'm going to root for it, and I'm probably going to go and watch it, regardless of what it is, because I want those films to keep being made.
The same thing can be said for television as well. I mean, I know that we're, you know, right now, you know, Squid Game's the biggest thing on you know, television or whatever you want to call it, and it is original, and that's fantastic. You know, but then you've got, you know, everyone wants their Squid Game now. Like, it's just, everyone's just going to chase that thing.
Television's a mess. Television's a mess and embarrassing.
I don't know. I mean, okay.
Squid Game to me is proof of one thing, and Phil, you're not going to like what I'm going to say.
Okay.
But it's proof of one thing, which is Netflix has a big old greater than sign, everything else. And there is no universe where any other platform could have launched a show like Squid Game. Squid Game puts it up with no advertising on its front page, mm-hmm. and it is the biggest fucking show in the world. That is surreal to me, and that's another thing altogether. But yeah, I mean, like, Paramount Plus, get your own Squid Game. Come on. How are you going to get people to watch Squid Game?
You know my feelings about Netflix, and it's not even that I hate Netflix.
I know you don't.
At all. I don't hate them at
all. No one is tweeting more about Maid than you.
It's true. Maid's great. I think that the bigger question I have, and Kenny and I have had this discussion many times over, but you know, Squid Game is all the rage right now, as it should be, and it's great. 6 weeks from now, no one's going to be talking about Squid Game anymore because it will have evaporated from the zeitgeist.
Oh yeah,
and totally I think that is the biggest problem they have is the not making
episodes at the same time.
Making a global phenomenon is not a problem. They can do that clearly, but making it so it stays in the zeitgeist and people continue to talk about it as a binge is antithetical. It's not
the churn rate is insane.
Yeah.
But they, at least right now, I mean, it does feel almost like a Ponzi scheme, but at least right now there seem to be more content feeding this beast than there are, you know, more content than we're going to run out. Like I don't think they're going to run out because they have so much money and because the most powerful piece of marketing real estate in the entire world is the Netflix front page. So you have that, you beat everything else.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. Yeah.
Which do you guys subscribe to? How many of you subscribe
to? I mean, all of them you know, ooh, that's just, if I had to cut, I could live without Peacock. I could live with that. I have AMC Plus. I have Shudder. I mean, I really have all of that. So
I'm not subscribed to those. I'm subscribed to Netflix, Hulu, Criterion Channel,
Criterion,
Disney
Plus, HBO Max. I mean, all the ones you Apple. I mean, all the
I
ones
would drop if Prime was a standalone service, I'd drop that. Prime does nothing for me, but you know, it's essentially
I don't know
free.
About nothing. But I don't watch much of it. I mean, listen, Kenny and I. The other thing too is that you know, with this podcast, which we love doing, we have a lot of shows, a lot of things to watch, a lot of movies to watch, and you know, when I can just say into my Apple TV such and such movie, and it pops up on one of the various streaming services that I subscribe to, it makes things a lot easier. I can guarantee you that. There's a bunch of movies that Kenny and I have watched on Amazon Prime just purely because it just happens to be there. But it's an interesting
world. Little things just popped up on my computer saying Squid Game has just reached 111 million views.
Okay, it came up?
It just popped up on my little, yeah.
See, all right, that to me is way more.
Because they're listening to us. That's
an example of them listening to us. Yes. It just came up on mine too. I'm kidding.
Did it? I'll just say this though, and this will be the last thing I say about Netflix. And this is something that Kenny knows is a bee in my bonnet. That's a meaningless statistic. This idea of a view and what they constitute as a view is inferior.
It's 2 minutes, isn't it?
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
I mean, I guarantee you that Kenny and I could probably come up with content that 100 million people would listen to 2 minutes of.
I mean, that's the credits. That's the opening title.
Kenny says no.
Not me. Maybe you. But I think, just as a sister point to that. Yes. Fucking, it's not as if Neil...
Are you all right, Kenny? Are you okay?
He's fine. He's good.
Are you a bit cross?
All right. Hold on. Let me get it out. Yes. The sister point to that is, that drives me nuts, is everybody complains that Netflix is cagey with their stats. It's not Netflix's job to tell you how many people watch the show, just as it's not NBC's job. NBC doesn't tell you how many people watch their shows. Nielsen tells you how many people.
Right.
And there is absolutely a way for Nielsen to monitor streaming. This is not that difficult.
I'll tell you something.
Nielsen is trying to.
I know. And it's weird that they're not good at it.
Well, because
it's really, really weird with C, which is out now on Apple. What do they call it?
I have it.
Apple TV Plus.
Apple TV Plus. That's the one. Yeah. It's really odd not having viewing, not knowing if it's being watched or not. I mean, I would rather know that I put something out and no one's watching it.
Mm-hmm. Rather than creator not really secret stats?
Nope.
Ugh. Can I ask? Here's the thing, Kenny. I don't necessarily take issue with. I agree with you. It is not their job to tell us how many people watch their things. What I don't like is this in-between bullshit.
I hear you.
They cherry-pick the fucking stuff that they want to tell us by their own bizarre metrics and then tout it as the biggest thing in the world. You don't need to tell me that Squid Game's the biggest show in the world. I know. It's all over every fucking social media that I subscribe to. I get it. It's a very big show. But this, then just give us the real hard facts. Don't give us some in-between step of like 111 million people watched at least 2 minutes of it. Well, how many people watched the whole fucking thing? Because those are the people that are actually invested in the show.
110 and just, a half, I think.
Right, sure, yeah.
Have you like, seen the like first episode?
Yeah, it's great. To get back to Sleepy Hollow, I want to just say, as we sidetracked, but the Ichabod backstory I don't really love. That being said, what I do love is the Iron Maiden. And I do love that's just, it's worth it just to see Lisa Marie fall out of a Iron Maiden, just, you know, in an ocean of blood. That's great. Great line that Ichabod has that feels like a total Tom Stoppard line is, perhaps there's a bit of witch in you because you've bewitched me.
I refuse to believe that Stoppard wrote that. He's the greatest living writer in the world. He did not write that. No.
Touche. I take it back. Was not Tom Stoppard. But it doesn't seem like something that Andrew Kevin Walker would write either. So, I mean, anyway.
It was improvised.
It was improvised. Yeah, exactly. So can we talk for a second about Miranda Richardson?
Yeah.
And how fucking great she is in this. Like, she's you can tell she's chewing the scenery, like everyone is in this, but like, she really kills this. First of all, I mean, I do love that she's kind of playing a dual role. She plays the witch in the woods as well, and you get a great jump scare of the eyeballs coming out at you and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, that was the other bit. That was a Burtonism slightly too far for me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the eyes
coming
eyes?
Out and the snake telling it. It's a bit cute. You know,
very cute. No, I agree with you. But Miranda Richardson, when you realize, I mean, pretty early on that she's the villain, but whatever, she's just really going for it. There's also like her and Jeffrey Jones having sex in the woods is not something I ever needed to see. I think we can all agree that was perhaps a bridge too far. But also like she's cutting herself. There's all sorts of weird shit going on with her. Like she's doing all sorts of.
Yeah.
Great. It's great stuff. Love it. But yeah. The shot of her in the garden, this is the other thing where this movie kind of on a plotting level where like she's in the garden, the horseman, it looks like he's about to cut her head off, but then Michael Gambon runs before he sees it. And you're just like, well, that's awfully convenient.
I was fine with that just because it's Gambon. It's Gambon running and being scared Gambon can do no wrong.
I agree.
So fuck you for even suggesting it.
My apologies. I take it back. Well, we'll double it.
He defended Toys pretty big time a couple days ago. So.
Dude, Toys is great, Kenny. We got to rewatch.
He's a big Gambon fan. Don't worry.
I'm a big Gambon fan. You know, it's funny. I didn't put Gambon two and two together. He's the villain.
Yeah, he's like the main.
No. He's the military.
Toys guy. The Robin Williams.
Yeah, he's like his stepdad or something like that. Uncle. Yeah. Wow.
It's great. That movie is Robin Williams, Robin Wright, Michael Gambon, and LL Cool J, and Joe Cusack.
That is Exhibit A. Why only Gilliam should do Gilliam, and only Burton should do Burton? Because that is Levinson being like, hey, I could do this. I won an Oscar. You know, like, try to stop me.
No, you can't.
Yeah, no.
Miranda Richardson, when she shows up in that crazy black velvet dress, that's like the most like Tim Burton villain dress that Colleen Atwood could make. It's just beautiful. It looks amazing. So Ichabod has a notebook at one point that he burns. Do you remember this? And in the notebook is like Katrina's name written in like cursive with like hearts next to it. It's like, is Ichabod literally a 12-year-old girl?
It's layers. That's how you create a nuanced character.
Layers. Yeah. It's great. To wrap this up, great chase sequence. Love the chase sequence at the very end. Horsemen chasing them. So many beautiful shots. The fight on the top of the horse-drawn carriage. All that stuff is just great. I love it. I don't know how they shot it. And Tim Burton, who, by the way, not the greatest action director in the world, it is a great action sequence for a guy who clearly doesn't give a shit about action.
And also the windmill. The windmill is
windmill's
the
great.
Perfect mix of the period the place and Burton's aesthetic. Just that one image of that windmill looking like that, that's everything from Sleepy Hollow, from Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow in one shot.
Couldn't agree with you more. Love the kiss at the end where he bites her, blood comes out of her mouth, and they dive into the tree. Just great stuff.
Love it.
And also the line, just in time for a new century, is a nice nod to 1999, which obviously Kenny and I are in the business of. But I did find myself, first of all, beautiful last shot of just this really beautiful crane shot over New York in 1899. And I couldn't help but think, like, and I'm not saying I want to do this, but you could absolutely make a television show about Ichabod solving crimes in New York in the 19th century with Katrina and Masbeth. Like, it's there for the taking. Someone,
I mean, if anyone's going to do it.
Yeah, I don't want to do it.
Guys.
But, so let's rate
just
this.
Don't focus on his witch wife. For God's sake.
I want to know about a mistake. How I want to know about Ichabod before he time traveled.
You want him in the Revolutionary War? You want just a show about that?
I want him after the Revolutionary War. Like we never knew, but he was resurrected in between.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
We never knew. Well, we found out later. Yeah. And he had
how many times do you think in a pitch in Hollywood someone has said, this is the story you didn't know about ... Fuck off. Anyway, moving on.
I know sure, the people I feel worst for in this town. Are the development execs. I think about it all the time. Like, have you ever seen a development exec schedule?
I live with one.
Oh, you live with one?
She's in her room all day long. She comes out at lunch.
It's crazy.
It's awful.
It's crazy. Really? Six pitches a day. They turn down pitches constantly, but six pitches a day, and they must be all the same pitches.
Yeah. I mean, listen. You can imagine what I hear on a daily basis. It's not great.
God, you are so lucky. I wish I lived at the development show.
So let's do our ratings and then let's do our Tim Burton movies so that we can all move on with our lives.
Let her know I feel bad for her.
Okay, I'll let her know. So I saw this movie in 99. I fucking loved it. I gave it like a 97 back in 99. I mean, I adored it. It was everything that I wanted it to be. Before this podcast, I've gone down a little bit, but as you can imagine, I haven't gone down much. I love this movie. I'm basically at a 93 pre and post. I love the film. I mean, I can nitpick. There are things that aren't perfect about it. I do wish that they gave, you know, Katrina a little bit more to do. Christina Ricci in particular, I feel, is such a great actor, and I kind of wish that she was given a little bit more to do. So, you know, there's little things here and there, but like, I could watch this movie every day. I adore it. But what about you, Kenny?
You know, I thought I had written this down somewhere, but I can't find it. So I'm just going to wing it. So I definitely saw this movie, not in 99, but in college at some point. I liked it. I didn't love it. I still don't love it. I mean, I think I would have given it like a 75 then. I think I would give it I would give it like an 83 before and after. I think it's really a really good movie. I don't think it's really good Burton. And that's not a huge knock on it, but I think it's not quite in the, and you'll see with my top five Burton, it's not exactly in that lane. I don't think it really lends itself to what I love about him as a director. I think he did a really good job with the material. Okay. And I think it looks incredible. And I have a lot of respect for what they've done with this. But ultimately, it's not going to be my favorite movie or my favorite kind of movie. Mm-hmm. 83 is good, though. It's a very good
at movie. The time, really liked it. Probably 80. And actually, it's gone up watching it again. I think my appreciation of it is so much more. So now, you know, 87.
Okay. All right.
I really, really enjoyed watching it. It's only not in the 90s because the end, I loved all of the action stuff, but that denouement went on for so long.
It did.
And I think rather spoiled it.
Before we go to our Burtons, I want to ask you both one more question.
Please.
Because, you know, and you answer it with the best of your own abilities. How much of this movie did you consciously run towards and consciously run away from when you were working on your own sleepy hollow?
Well, okay. I mean, I will say that for me personally, when I was coming up with it, or with the concept of it, I don't know that I really thought that much about it, if I'm being completely frank.
Interesting.
Because I had forgotten when we were making ours that in the Burton one, the horseman was formerly a Hessian soldier.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten that there was so much witchcraft involved. And
yeah, I mean,
neither of those things were from the book, but they made it into the show.
I imagine that, I mean, if you were to ask Alex, I bet he would say that this was a big touchstone for him more so. Like, I think that in my brain, I was really just trying to create a television show and was less trying to attach ourselves to the movie in its own way. Mm-hmm. I think also because our thing was modern, and because the Revolutionary War figured into it, the timeline in my brain, they just didn't speak to each other because this movie is at a different time. So that's why I didn't think about it that much. I would also say too, that the Ichabod and Abby relationship, which is obviously so paramount to our show, obviously is not in the movie. So that was really kind of one of the things that I was really trying to sort of focus on. So that was probably.
Yeah. His Ichabod and our Crane were just wildly different characters.
Yeah, totally.
They were
totally.
So obviously different on the page. And plus, with the relationship with Abby, in the movie, mm-hmm. Ichabod's the lead, but I always thought of Abby as the lead of our show. And Ichabod,
it's funny. That's a totally valid takeaway. Like, I think that because she is in our time, because so much of our mythology,
she's the guide. Yeah. She's the one who takes him.
Yeah. Abby definitely, at least in the beginning, was conceived as the lead. Mm-hmm. I think she was the lead, but
and that's why I think we'd then struggled as we said showing more of Crane, because he should be a
mystery,
oddity. Yeah.
No, I agree. I think that it's there were any number of sorry, go
ahead. No, she's the level-headed detective. Mm-hmm. And Crane was the eccentric genius person, the eccentric expert, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. Over the course of, you guys did what, 80 episodes? Something like that. Over the course of 80 episodes, of course, you're going to, get into that character's mindset and his POV over and over again. But yeah, that's a big difference between the two pieces.
And also, I wanted to avoid it because Johnny Depp is such a remarkable actor and beautiful and just, it's Johnny Depp. And so if you're playing a character that he's played, it must be like...
Well, that was one of the things that I appreciated so much about your performance, Tom, is that you made it your own, right? Like, there was no... You're not going to copy him. You're not going to do what Johnny does. You want to make it your own. We tried to do everything we could to make our version of this, which was obviously very different in its own way. And I think we succeeded at that. But I do think that the movie... I love the movie, as you'll see when I do my top five, that it still holds a place in my heart, not just because of the show, obviously, but just of what he was trying to do. But should we do our Burtons?
Yeah,
I'll start.
It's such a difficult question.
Can I just say, Kenny, and we'll surprise you, not at all. It was really hard. This was the hardest top five I've had to do.
Interesting. Yeah, me too. Well,
I struggle with four out of the five of these as to where they fall in this ranking daily changes. Yeah. So today this is what it is, but I imagine tomorrow it could be something.
Would you say?
But also with a lot of his films, I've not seen them for years and years.
Right.
When I was a kid, he was so important to me. He was my favorite director for such a long time, but I haven't watched these for at least 10 years, most of them.
I think mine are different than yours, but
I think yours will be different than mine.
Let's go ahead and do it.
So my number five is Sleepy Hollow. I don't need to say we've talked about this movie for several hours now, but I'll just say this. In terms of Tim Burton's oeuvre and his filmmaking and what have you, I think that this film is the most successful attempt as a filmmaker of taking something, a genre of filmmaking that he loves, and translating that into a movie that stands on its own two feet. He's tried to do that several times and has fallen on his face most times. So this is the movie that he obviously loved Hammer horror films. He obviously loved this genre, and he dove headfirst into it. And I think he was quite successful in doing it. I also think that it's arguably his most beautiful looking movie. If you talk about production value, if you talk about Tim Burton, you can't help but talk about set design and talk about all those things. And I think that this film is the perfect distillation of that for me personally. So that's why it's my number five. Kenny, what's your...
My number five is I think this is where I start to deviate, like, right away. My number five is Beetlejuice.
Okay.
Which I love, which I've shown my kids, and I think it's an amazing, fun, incredible movie. I love Michael Keaton's performance in it. I love Winona Ryder in it. I love everyone who sits around the table and sings Deo. I think it's a fantastic movie about how fun it would be to be dead.
We watched it last year with my son, and he was five at the time. And there are bits of it that are a lot darker than
randier.
But he loved it. He loved it, and he dressed up as Beetlejuice for Halloween last year, and he loved it, and I loved it. And what's so striking about it is Michael Keaton's hardly in it.
Yeah, I know.
Beetlejuice has a really small role in it. Yeah. But as it, it's Burton doing what he does best. And that's an iconic character. An iconic character who's only in the film for 20 minutes.
Yep.
I really like, there are a couple, one that I've left off, but a couple of his films where the color palette is so specific to that movie.
Totally.
And if you showed people like the 10 colors he uses, well, frame for sure, but even just the colors, you'd be like, Beetlejuice. And that's true for a lot of his films, actually, which I really love and respect about, you know, the way he puts his mark on what he does.
What's your number five, Tom?
My number five, I really, really wanted one of his animations in my top five, but I couldn't. I couldn't put it. And Corpse Bride was nearly going to be the number five. And then I realized it's just because I want an M. If he had directed
Nightmare
Before Christmas, that would definitely be probably near the top of my list. I was desperate for it, but didn't make it. Instead, and this was such a difficult thing, and it changed in the week since you sent me a text and said, prepare your five. It changed daily. But number five, Sleepy Hollow.
There you go.
Like you said, when you've got that DP and it looks like that, and it's so much fun. And Christopher Walken, it's made the list because of Walken's pervy look at the very end.
No one does a pervy look like Chris Walken. My number four is Beetlejuice. For all the reasons that we've said, I also just think it's worth highlighting too that that movie makes not a lick of fucking sense. If you think about it in any way on a script level, like if we sat down to read that script, we'd be like, wait, so why are they on Saturn? Why are there sandworms? What? Like, it's just it doesn't it really doesn't make any sense, and it
really doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
More than most people.
More than and I think most, that it's an unfortunate lesson to some degree that Tim Burton learned from that film, which is it doesn't matter if it makes sense. And sometimes it does matter. But in this particular instance, that movie is just a magnificent. Every time I watch it, I'm just like, this movie is gonzo, wonderful, everything about it. I love it. So that's my number four. What's your four, Kenny?
My four is Batman. I love Batman. Batman's great. One of the first movie-going experiences I remember. We're going to do a whole episode of them on Batman on the Patreon. There's not too much to say, but obviously Batman is an extremely important movie and not an obvious Burton movie, but I think it kind of opened up this other land that he's really good at. So
I agree. What's your number four, Tom?
Batman Returns.
Ooh.
Batman didn't make my top five, but Batman Returns in at number four. It starts to become a little more Burton-esque than the first film.
For sure.
Particularly with the Penguin. I'd love Christopher Nolan. He's one of the last auteurs, and he's one of the best British directors ever. But watching his Batman films, all I kept thinking was he would never cast Danny DeVito. And I struggled with that.
Never.
Danny DeVito is perfect. Michelle Pfeiffer is absolute perfection in that film. Keaton is amazing.
I have a feeling this again is going to come up again.
Yeah, this movie's going to come up again. Don't you worry.
Good. So, Batman Returns. And I'm still questioning whether it should be higher.
My three is Edward Scissorhands. Edward Scissorhands is a weird movie for me because as a kid, when I saw it in the theater, it was 10, it came out in 90. It actually scared me and I was like, I don't like this. It just did not work for me. Subsequently, I think it's a masterpiece. I think that if you told Tim Burton he could only have one movie that was shot into space that was like him, I think it's Edward Scissorhands. Like, I think that it does all the things. I mean, he is Edward Scissorhands for all intents and purposes, like him growing up in Burbank. It's just the most autobiographical Tim Burton movie. Just a magnetic performance, a star-making performance from Johnny Depp. I love it to death. It's great. I mean, what can be said about Edward Scissorhands? Danny Elfman's score, all of it's great. That's my number.
It's so great and it's so iconic, but it didn't make my list.
It also didn't make my list. And it
was between that and Beetlejuice for sixth. I mean, they're both amazing films. They're the two most Burton-esque films.
And, what's your three?
And I don't disagree with you. I think Edward Scissorhands is everything for me, but it's not as funny and winning and wonderful and weird and goofy and pleasurable.
I agree with all that.
Big Adventure.
Well,
Pee-wee's Big Adventure is my number three.
Great.
As much fun as you can have at the movies. So fun, so silly. Sure. Such a great time. I mean, that I absolutely love Pee-wee's Big Adventure because the thing about Pee-wee's Big Adventure is that it very much takes place in the real world. Everybody who populates the world is a total fucking lunatic. But the world itself is real, and I absolutely love that about the movie. And I think Paul Reubens is unbelievably awesome in that film.
So do I. And also, what an amazing decision of his to pick this young director who had never directed a feature before. But
I love Pee Wee.
Be able to populate a real world with otherworldly things.
Yeah.
You really do have to hand it to Paul Reubens for seeing the vision and seeing like the potential in Tim Burton at that stage in his career for sure. And I love Pee-wee, don't get me wrong. Let me rephrase. I love Pee-wee's Big Adventure as a film. I actually don't really love the Pee-wee character, which is why it's not in my top five.
Well, I love Pee-wee in Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Right.
And I also love the show, but the other movies he's in, it's not the same.
I mean, he is the
recent
dad,
one is fucking great too. He's forget it. I love Pee-wee. He's amazing.
Pee-wee's great. What's your three, Tom?
Edward. It nearly didn't. There were days when it wasn't on my five. There were days when it was higher up. It's obviously his best film. It's obviously his best made film. It's terrific, and it's
so that's
there for
your
me.
That's your number three.
That's my number three. And it has to be in a Burton list. The performances, every single performance is...
Everyone. Bill Murray?
Perfect. Ugh. Bill Murray is so amazing in it. Yeah. And it's his best made. It's terrific. It's terrific.
It's wonderful. It's higher up on my list. So I'll talk about it when I get to it. But I adore it. My number two. So this is where I struggle
right now.
This is my two. This was the so this was the hardest choice for
this
me.
The
to
weirdest
make.
The, this is the weirdest thing of all time that's about to happen.
Yeah. So my number two is Batman Returns.
That's the weirdest thing of all time to me.
I really struggled with this. This was like because anyone who listens to any podcast I've ever been on knows that I love Batman Returns more than anything. I think that
I
the
thought it was like
that,
your favorite movie.
It's one of my favorite movies. I'm talking about Tim Burton's top five films, and I think that. I mean, you could obviously guess what my number one is. I struggled with this one and two placement because I love Batman Returns so, so much.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I came back to just the purity of I'm not the biggest biopic fan in the world. And I really do think that Ed Wood's one of the best biopics you could ever make.
So do your two and one right now.
Yeah, I'm going to kind of do
you
them.
Did
yeah.
it. So because
yeah,
I'll yeah. do the mine too.
So Batman Returns, I mean, listen, I have run out of words for my love for Michelle Pfeiffer's performance in Batman Returns. As anyone who's listened to the podcast I did about Batman Returns on Norm Wilner's podcast, it is just everything that I love about Batman and about Tim Burton. Is a weird, weird movie about weird people that just don't fit in the world and don't know how to love and be human. And like, it's just, it's a deep, dark, weird, beautifully made movie. Everything about it is perfect. I really have no flaws with Batman Returns. In terms of Ed Wood, I think the reason that I gave it the slightest of edges over Batman Returns is because of just the amount of love for filmmaking. You know, Tim Burton is yeah. not a filmmaker that talks much about his process, who talks much about why he does what he does. And Ed Wood just feels like the most open-hearted love letter to the making of motion pictures and why people do it. And on top of all of that, it is just brimming with the weirdest group of people that he could possibly. Like, it's just, it's got a whole bunch of weirdos in it. I mean, Sarah Jessica Parker, who's great in it. Bill Murray and everybody in it is just fantastic. The only bummer is that Danny Elfman didn't do the score. It's the only score of Tim Burton's movies that is not Danny Elfman, but Howard Shore did a very good job. But yeah, so ultimately, yeah. long story short, love both these films. They're basically both number one. I mean, I don't know.
But you had to choose, and you do.
I had to choose, and that's what I chose today.
My number one and number two are the same movies,
just inverted
and inverted.
Yeah,
because I agree with both of you. I do think Ed Wood is his best film.
Yeah.
And Batman Returns is my favorite. So,
I can't argue with that. I agree.
I went with my favorite, but I wouldn't just go with my favorite if I didn't also think that it's best in breed, right? Like, I think it is the best superhero movie.
Yeah.
I think it is the best Christmas movie. I mean, I think like when we were talking about the production design of Sleepy Hollow, I kind of swallowed my tongue because I knew we'd be talking about Batman Returns later. And Batman Returns is the Burton movie where I'm jaw dropped every moment.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, totally agree with Dan on the Danny DeVito thing. I think Max Schreck is an unbelievable character that you only have to watch the movie to understand how integral he is to the plot and the mechanics. And then obviously, Michelle Pfeiffer's performance, obviously, Michael Keaton's performance, but what this movie has that no other movie in this genre has ever had is that chemistry. The chemistry between the two of them is, it's a bonfire.
And a giant duck with penguins.
It does.
Rockets.
And it has a giant duck. This movie genuinely terrified me the first time I saw it in the theaters.
Oh, yeah.
Any film would be improved by a giant duck.
Yeah. It is a weird, like, weirdly, this movie scared me when I was in the theaters, weirdly in the 90s. So this came out, I think, in 95, right, Phil?
92.
And 92. So some point in the 90s, probably around 95, 96, I had this urge to go and rent this movie. A movie that I didn't particularly love in the theaters and started like a 25-year love affair with it because I think it's the greatest. I think it's just...
I didn't like it in the theater either.
I had it on VHS. I didn't see it in the cinema. I had it on VHS. And my brother and I watched that VHS every single weekend.
Yeah.
For so about good. A year. And that's and not an exaggeration. We'd have a little bit of time while dinner was getting ready and we'd pop on Batman Returns and obsessed with it. Loved it.
I love the original Batman. I love the original Batman. And you know, part of the reason why I think I was turned off in the beginning with Batman Returns is because I love the original Batman so much, but there's a place in my heart now for both. That being said, Batman doesn't fucking hold a candle to Batman Returns.
I agree with you. Obviously, wholeheartedly agree with everything you're saying. I you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I think is worth mentioning too, in this comic book world that we live in, where, you know, there's a million of these fucking movies and what have you, I still don't think a film has juggled the idea of multiple villains as well as Batman Returns did. They're all really feeding each other thematically, from a plot perspective, all of that stuff so beautifully. And yet we've seen everyone fuck it up since. It is kind of shocking.
How about that last shot? Yeah, that wasn't even her. That wasn't even supposed to be in it.
It wasn't even her. What's your two and one, Tom?
Brace yourselves. Uh-oh. Number two is Beetlejuice.
Okay. The juice.
Love it. The juice. I always loved
it. The juice is
loose. I watched it again. It might be because, with the exception of watching Sleepy Hollow a few weeks ago, it's the most recent one that I watched.
Yeah.
Number one, get ready, and it's out of, this is one that I've not watched for probably about 15 years, but it holds such a special place in my heart. It's Mars Attacks. Even after talking about CG and Burton being better without CG, it holds it as, I love sci-fi. I love sci-fi.
Sure.
And to see him do Tim Burton's Ed Wood sci-fi.
I want
to
watch it right now.
With Tom Jones punching, you know, aliens in the face and showing, come on girls, and hurrying showgirls out of Vegas. Fucking great. With the idea that it's an accidental war because some hippie releases a dove.
Correct.
And that frightens the piss out of them and infuriates them, and that starts global cataclysm, and then accidentally someone pulls the headphones out of the socket of an old woman listening to country music, and they discover country music makes their brains explode.
Yeah. Here's what I
think. Look of it, the design of it, I think is perfect. I love, in my brain, I love this film, and I'll probably go and watch it again next week, and I'll probably
just to be clear, I love Mars Attacks.
I think I might watch it next couple of days. Yeah.
It is a great movie. I think
Jack Nicholson is excellent. Pierce Brosnan is hilarious. Is Sarah Michelle?
Sarah Jessica Parker.
Sarah Jessica Parker gets her head put on a
chihuahua. I'll say this though.
Glenn Close is in it.
One of the things that I think is great about it is that it's at least pretty clear to me that he's like, what movie would Ed Wood make if he got $100 million?
Yes, quite.
And he made it. Is lovely. And he made it. And more power to him. I love Mars Attacks. I think that's a bold and awesome number one pick.
Great choice.
It's a great pick. Tom, we cannot thank you enough for coming on to talk about Sleepy Hollow.
Thank you enough. I'd really have nothing else to do. I'd just be sitting in a dark corner. Thinking about you, and thank you for giving me a purpose.
This was everything that I could have wanted from this episode, which I was nervous about doing and how to do it. And this is everything that I could have wanted it to be. So I appreciate both of you letting me rant. But this was absolutely wonderful. We can't wait to have you all to talk about Beau Travail at some point.
This is what the world needs. They need, a 2-hour long meditation on the male physique.
Can I just say that
in
someone
French, as thought of by a fucking flouncing 1940s thesp throwback and a fucking neurotic Jewish writer in LA and fucking Kenny.
Yeah, it's gonna be great. Kenny is also a neurotic Jewish writer.
I was dying to hear what you were gonna say about me, and fucking Kenny is perfect.
Can I just say though, that someone DM'd me on Twitter when we released the schedule for October that said that you were coming on for Sleepy Hollow. And they were like, can't wait to listen to this. Super excited. So thrilled that it's not that weird French movie.
I don't know.
The weird French movie is coming.
That French movie, Beau Travail, has my favorite ending of any film ever.
It's been on many lists of best endings. I haven't read any of it. I've never read what it is.
I've never seen it, so I can't wait. All right, let's do it soon. So we can watch it.
We're going to do this. Tom, thank you again. One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. Podcast like it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.